Combatants, you have a new tasking order. We're gonna be talking about the great film. Instead of we're talking about science fiction novels, we're talking about the great, is it science fiction or science fact film? Delph. The logical next thing for us to be talking about here on Marooned on Mars, Stealth from 2005. I am your Talon One pilot, Matt. This is so stupid. Best opening ever. So we got Talon One, Talon Two, and Talon Three. We got Matt, Hillary, and Bill talking movies. We're marooned at the movies this week.
Truly, right? Truly marooned this week with one. What I will say is one of the worst movies I have seen. At least recently.
At least it was competently made. Bill, why are we watching this movie? You're a big fan. You're a big, big fan of this film.
You know, I knew early on that I was going to be called to task to account for the fact that I had told both of you that I've seen this movie multiple times. That I will also watch it again multiple times. I have a little secret trick to watching it, which makes it slightly better. I think we're watching this because you picked it, my friend. This is my little secret shame. I wouldn't have put my affection for this film on Front Street.
I see. So you recommended it to me and I watched it. And then I thought it was so bad that it would be something that the three of us could have fun talking about.
That's right. That's right. I'll tell you my little secret before we get into it. So that as we discuss the plot, listeners can imagine the best version of this movie, which is if there's not a plane on screen, you should fast forward to the next time there's a plane on screen. And it's so much more fun. It's vibrant, dynamic, exciting, explosive.
Right. If you just like skip all the human parts.
Yeah. Yeah. They're terrible.
Ostensibly human parts.
This is a extended Incubus music video, this film. So for fans of Incubus, you're in for a treat.
Yeah, I'm going to say it takes a special movie to be both full of Incubus songs and not have that be the worst part of the viewing experience.
It's a handful of Incubus songs, but one in particular that just gets played over and over again. But I will try to recount the plot of this very conventional film as quickly as possible. One thing I will say is if you get the Blu-ray, the only extra on the Blu-ray is a promotional video that promotes the technology of Blu-ray, the new Blu-ray technology. This is a film from 2005. That's awesome. And it has Rob Cohen, the director, who is better known as the director of the first Fast and Furious film. And then mostly he's been a producer of other things. And that this promotional video of the new Blu-ray technology is just a music video, again, with Incubus on the background. Oh, wow. And the video has like surfing and military jets and just general jingoism, which is the essential vibe of the film as well. The film takes place in the milieu of the Naval Air Force. The opening sort of credit roll says the Naval Air Force, the near future. To combat the mounting threat of terrorism, a new program has been created. Armed with the most advanced and experimental technology, its purpose is to destroy the enemy wherever they operate in the world. Over 400 pilots applied for the program. 3 were chosen, so meritocracy is in full effect here.
Yeah.
It actually takes 4 times as long to read the opening crawl as Matt is performing it now, because it's really just flashing up about a dozen words at a time.
Yeah. This is not a movie made for people who have a lot of with written language.
Oh gosh.
I mean, I don't honestly, I don't know who this movie is made for, but I mean, I'm assuming like pre-reading children, you know, like
most, you know, of the American movie going public, yes,
kindergartners, sure. First graders, kind of, yeah. Right on target.
Yeah, it is a piece of American military propaganda, obviously, in the age of the war on terror, in the height of the war on terror, 2005-2006. What we find are the three, you know, the three meritocratic best pilots in the world who are, you know, flying in sort of formation and perfect cohesion, competence. They are Talons 1, 2, and 3, aka Josh Lucas, playing Ben, who's one of the least remarkable people I've ever seen on film before. He's, I would say,
remarkable only for his I mean, perhaps extraordinary ability to appear to be a human being. Yeah.
Josh, who's that guy who's not Ryan Gosling? Lucas.
Generic, beyond the dreams of Ben Affleck.
He is definitely not Ryan Gosling. But here's the thing I'll say about Josh Lucas. Yeah. Secretly much older than you think he is.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah.
Because I had to Google him because I kept thinking, is this somebody I have seen before or I have not seen before? And it turns out where I've seen him before is he plays young Kevin Costner in the Yellowstone flashback sequences.
Oh, how interesting. What? Okay.
Which is kind of interesting because in theory, he does look like Kevin Costner, but in practice, he has no personality and therefore looks the most like, who's the guy who plays Captain America?
Chris Evans.
He's like, to me, he's like the same person, but he's like 15 years older than Chris Evans or something.
He plays young Kevin Costner on Yellowstone, but he's born in 1971, so he's 50 years old. How, like, okay, whatever.
Yes,
okay.
He plays young really well, and I would like to congratulate him for that.
Sweet Home Alabama,
to
Ford
accept
versus
the
Ferrari.
Award for best looking old young guy.
Whatever. Okay. So Talon 1 is Josh Lucas. Talon 2 is Jessica Biel, aka Kara. Her name is Kara.
I thought her name was Caraway the whole movie, but it turns out to be Kara Wade.
Kara Wade. Okay. And then born in 1982, so 10 years younger than Josh Lucas. They are obviously going to be a romantic couple, although, again, two charisma negative people with like superficial attractive qualities. And then you just put them together and they're supposed to have some kind of romantic explosive chemistry. And then Talon 3.
I don't remember hers, but his call sign, Josh Lucas's call sign is just big.
Big? Are you serious?
Yeah. Call sign big.
Is it because he's Big Ben?
Well, that would almost make sense, except on the side of his plane it says Ben Big Gannon. They don't even take advantage of the joke.
I didn't even notice. So like, it's hard to even know their names and definitely their call signs. Like you would expect, I don't know. I'm trying to do the plot here. We're getting into the weeds.
Yeah.
Jamie Foxx plays Henry, and he was born in 1967. So he's actually the oldest of the three, fascinatingly. Yeah. That doesn't mean anything either. Okay. So Jamie Foxx, these are the three heroic pilots. We have Sam Shepard as their sort of commanding officer. And then we have, what's his name? Joe Morgan? No, wait, not Joe Morgan.
Joe Morton.
Yeah. Who best known to our listeners from Terminator 2, Michael Dyson. Is it Michael Dyson? Whatever. The guy who quote unquote invents the Terminator robots, whatever.
And the vacuum.
These are our main competitors. we open on a training exercise. The Talons are going through their final paces. Nothing less than precision is expected from this program. They are taking out targets. They're flying through the air. They're bombing stationary trucks and mannequins. They are in complete sync with each other. They accomplish the training exercise 100 over 100, as they say many, many times. In the debrief, there is nothing better that they could do. They are eating popsicles. Meaningful sexual glances are being exchanged between Josh Lucas and Jessica Biel's. There's no room for improvement. They're given an order to report to the USS Abraham Lincoln, an aircraft carrier, where they will engage in their new assignment and be receiving a new wingman their three-person squadron, which immediately makes Jamie Foxx apprehensive because three is a lucky number and four is an unlucky number.
I mean, and so because it turns out there is room for improvement. Just not on the human plane.
Well, we don't know that yet. They speculate about who might be the person to, the person to join them when they're out for drinks. And basically Jamie Foxx and George Lucas are being almost having sex at the bar because they're flyboys and like women just can't resist men in uniform. Meanwhile, Jessica Biel is just there, just sadly sipping her drink, pining over Big Ben Gannon sitting right next to her. They go out to the club. Lucas absconds with a young woman, Floozy, and Jessica Biel's just gives him a boys will be boys kind of look, and then they leave. They're on the aircraft carrier in the Philippine Sea. Sam Shepard, George Cummings, meets up with Josh Lucas, with Ben, says, "Here's your new wingman." A plane materializes out of nowhere. It lands Harrier style. It's an unmanned aerial vehicle, an unmanned combat aerial vehicle, a UCAV with quantum processing and VLO stealth, which stands for very low observable stealth. It is the Extreme Deep Invader, EDI, or EDI.
EDI.
Associated especially with horrible early 90s pop music, especially Incubus. They have to read about him. He is going through all their flight logs to perfectly sync up with how they do their business. There's a scene of like Jessica Biel bouncing on a yoga ball, which is meant to express some kind of sexual frustration. Her underwear is all hanging up. Josh Lucas comes in. They flirt. Humorless, no chemistry between them. The next day they go on their first practice run, these three humans and a unmanned combat aerial vehicle. They are immediately given a new tasking order to do 9/11 in Rangoon.
To do 9/11 in Rangoon. Strangely, they I guess post summary, we can get into the exceedingly bizarre geopolitics of this movie, which seems to think that it's like, I mean, mostly I think the premise is like, this will both be this like sort of cartoonish, fun fantasy that's like, you know, driving fast cars, but they're airplanes. And also, we will show how American military might can wipe out. I think it's supposed to be kind of the axis of evil because we hit. It's a little bit unclear. It's a little bit unclear to me what's supposedly going on in Myanmar. But we do hit both North Korea, surprisingly, an extensive amount of North Korea, and also, I guess, the USSR, basically.
So that they get this emergency mission redirect. I took extensive notes.
Sorry.
They're going to undertake.
I don't mean to leap ahead.
They're going to take a tactical action into Rangoon because the heads of three terrorist cells are planning an imminent attack on U.S. soil. And they're doing this in the new defense ministry of Myanmar, yes, which is a building in downtown Rangoon.
Yes.
EDI, the hyper extraordinarily bizarre. I mean, just this is the imagination of like total information awareness, in the age of the internet and, you know, satellite technology. But to speak to your question, actually, and jump ahead a little bit, you know, this is a, I think this is, film is a Western where the frontier is the entire rest of the world that's not the United States of America. And the cavalry is authorized to undertake deadly force wherever and whenever it sees fit, right? It is just like U.S. imperialism on a kind of, with a kind of carte blanche authorization to invade, to ignore borders and do whatever it deems necessary to, again, fight the war on terror, which is both, it seems focused on state actors, not really non-state actors, or just a combination of the two, because three terrorist cells are meeting in the Defense Ministry of Myanmar.
Yeah. I mean, so that's when we see the three leaders of the terrorist cells, you know, in the usual way that you would on a show like, you know, Homeland or whatever, like a still from like a zoomed in satellite shot. And basically it looks like they're being sent in to like wipe out like three leaders of like the Third Worldist movement. I mean, there's this weird, it's like, it's basically like a black guy and two brown guys. I mean, yeah. So what, you know, it's not even, the movie for some reason does not even really traffic in the like set of signs for this person is a terrorist. It is to me like more incoherent than that. It's like a little bit a set of like the bad actors are really all just like characters from like movies from like the 50s or 60s, maybe, you know. Anyway, the point is, of course, that we don't really care.
Three guys from like different James Bond movie cold opens, like guy who's on screen for 5 minutes and then gets killed by James Bond in some hot country.
Yeah, right. And they're able, Eddie, so they're flying in, it's downtown Rangoon. Jessica Biel is the risk assessment officer, and she calculates thousands of collateral victims and says, there's no way we can do this without killing innocent people. And we're the good guys and we don't kill innocent people, we just kill guilty people. Eddie goes ahead and taps into all information in the world and verifies that these are in fact the three people who, you know, they suspect them to be. And he does so by somehow reading their biometric information, eye scans, voice patterns, and fingerprints. He's able to fingerprint one of these guys with kind of like CSI technology, but, you know, using satellite imagery and stuff. So like the total information awareness spectrum or panopticon, right? So these are the three guys. They are in this place. There's no way to do this, but Eddie says, no, there is a way to do it. If you drop a missile directly on top, going straight down, you can do it. And of course, this would be no problem for an unmanned combat aerial vehicle like Extreme Deep Invader Eddie. But Josh Lucas, Ben, you know, he's not operational. Eddie's not operational yet. This is just a test run. But Ben is like, he's got fucking three first names. How am I going to keep this guy? Okay, it's Ben, Josh, Lucas, big. He's going to, like, he can do it because he's the best pilot in the world. So he flies up very high in the sky, flies straight down, drops a missile straight down in the, like, directly in the top of the building. It goes down in there, penetrates. He then, like, takes, you know, Top Gun style, takes his, you know, flies his plane helpful, you know, out of there. He almost blacks out into downtown Myanmar, right up Broadway.
Right.
Building
right.
explodes 100 over 100, surgical precision, no collateral damage. They do it. It was amazing.
But I mean, basically the problem with doing this particular thing is that you might pass out, which is a really hilarious, you know, version of a problem for this guy to have. And so, yeah, I mean, like the movie throughout has this problem of wanting, like, simultaneously, like, it is clearly a movie made to celebrate not yet existent, but potentially existent forms of military hardware. But also because just like in general, in, you know, cultural documents of this kind, you can't be on the side of artificial intelligence. You have to be suspicious of artificial intelligence. It, you know, like it has this kind of problem of like both wanting to like, you know, and so we know that like the movie has to come down on the side of like the human operator and not the AI operator. But then that makes this little like difficulty because also it's supposed to be celebrating this new kind of technology. So we have this sort of problem, you know, really actually I think kind of throughout the movie, it keeps like running into this. And actually I think the solution to this problem is kind of hilarious and funny, but we're not there. And then also because of the Josh Lucas character, such as he is, he's also supposed to be both like, you know, because we don't want just like, you know, he's just like a good guy who thinks about the right thing to do or whatever. We also need him to be like a daredevil, bad boy, fly rule boy,
yeah,
whatever, a rule breaker.
Yeah.
And so we both need him to be like motivated by like a set of like, you know, ethical concerns, which primarily turn into how he has to rescue Jessica Biel from North Korea, just, you know, to point us ahead a little bit.
Right.
But also like, you know, he has to be taught something of a lesson, which he really, the movie does not in fact teach him any kind of lesson at all.
No.
Nor can it figure out how to grapple with its whole, like, I mean, its picture of what artificial intelligence is hilarious, right? So one of the things that it has to do is like both we have to be like, oh my God, this total information awareness thing is amazing because we could just precision kill all of the bad guys in the world and then everything will be okay. And at the same time, we have to be slightly suspicious of that because, of course, like we're Americans, so we care about like civil liberties. So we're slightly scared when we see that these things are happening. So like that both comes to us through the person of EDI Eddie, the quantum computer, and therefore we're slightly suspicious of it. But also we still get to kill those guys. So, you know, cake, eat it too, et cetera, et cetera. And then hilariously right after this, so they're all flying back. You know, Josh Lucas, thank God he recovered from almost passing out. You know, nobody was hurt. Nobody
flying like Mach 4 or whatever.
Nobody in Rangoon was hurt, except for the three bad guys who were affirmed to be true bad guys based on retinal scans. You know, and then they're flying back and there's like a lightning storm and fucking Eddie gets hit by lightning and it scrambles his brain, his quantum brain. Eddie is the quantum computer. And then that sets us up for what would then seem to be the central problem of the movie, which is that the quantum computer flying this incredibly expensive pseudo semi-stealth, what's it called? Low-res stealth, high-vis stealth.
Very low observable stealth. Okay.
Very low observable stealth.
Which they don't ever really seem to need stealth because they're flying so fast over countries with no air defenses that are completely unsuspecting of their like internationally illegal like incursions into their national airspace that blow up buildings in the middle of like, what do they care about being stealthy if they just, okay, whatever.
Well,
if they
have the power
of God, like Thor coming down and like, just blasting people off the face of the earth, Obama style.
because it turns out that other than, you know, as far as we can tell, this little like chunk we see of Southeast Asia, everyone else in the world who is not an American is a peasant. Like everybody, yes. All the other humans we see who are not in the American Navy on the real, you know, naval ship, the Abraham Lincoln, everybody else is literally is a peasant or yeah.
You're either in the military or you're a farmer.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Or you're a tech guru.
That lightning strike scene is particularly good. You know, you get in one of those classic Rob Cohen, like shot, the classic. Camera follows something weird going through the machine. And in that lightning strike scene, you know, you get the charge traveling through Eddie's circuits, which ends up on a close up of DNA getting exploded by the whole situation, by the whole lightning strike, which is, you know, that's what a great moment that is.
Yes. Which,
a great moment. And then is later explained to us that that was by a tech guy who then conveniently disappears. I don't know where the tech guy ends up going, but that was the AI's neural net,
right,
was damaged,
right,
which its neural net is DNA. Yeah.
The neural net is not shaped like a neural, like a brain neural net. It's shaped coincidentally like human DNA, strange, which is not your neural
I
net.
Mean, a few things, I think there's a few things going on, right? So like Eddie has been, cause he's got the total information awareness. So he's read all the flight logs of the three Talon operators, right? And he has like glommed onto the leader, you know, Talon One, Big Ben Gannon. And so he's like learning from them. And they, like, this is the problem, right? Is that this is part of the problem. We have these unmanned area assault vehicles. They can do whatever, wherever. And therefore, we can kill all the bad guys. But if they also have quantum engineered artificial intelligence, then we have to make sure that they're going to follow orders appropriately, because we're the holders of moral authority as human beings.
Right.
And if an autonomous vehicle can make its own decisions, then that's a problem, because it might learn the wrong things. It might learn not what we, you know, might learn by watching us rather than by taking our orders. And that's exactly what they learn. He learns from Josh Lucas, is that Lucas is ordered, Ben is ordered to like stand down, do not do this. And he's like, no, I can do it. And he fakes a radio, you know, malfunction where he can't hear the orders from the captain, right? Goes, oh, you're breaking up. I can't hear you. I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway, because I'm assuming you're telling me that I'm a great guy and I'm going to go ahead and do it. And Eddie's like, oh, that's how you like accomplish your mission. You like pretend that you can't hear the orders being given to you, right? And the lightning. So you would think that would be all that would be necessary for the computer to like mislearn it. But the lightning strike also gives an overdetermined reason, because the lightning strike not only hits Eddie, it also hits Talon One, and the DNA somehow I don't know, some like DNA memory of Josh Lucas transfers via lightning electricity into Eddie's quantum computer.
Oh, you think that's what happens?
The lightning strike hit both airplanes.
Well, it hits both airplanes, but I just thought that was like, this is our understanding of what a neural net is. It's like the DNA of the non-biological entity.
There would be no reason.
I love that reading. I mean, it's brilliant. I do think it's total headcanon and not what the movie intends, but I love it.
There's no reason for the lightning bolt to hit both planes unless Ben's DNA of being a rebel is also going to get transferred through the lightning strike.
You know what makes that really, I think what makes, what I think it cashes that out as a proposition then is their eventual joining, you know, which I'm sure we'll get to at the end.
Hillary's got her hand raised. Hillary wants to make a comment.
They become mutually embodied.
Yeah, because this is right. The lightning strike is hilarious because it is the way in which it has to happen, because otherwise you have this problem, which is like, oh, but we think that having an artificial intelligence be the one deciding about bombing people, and not just deciding about bombing people, but actually doing it, we think that's a bad idea. And we think that partly because part of our suspicion of artificial intelligence is weirdly the same as our suspicion of the person who obeys all the rules, right? So we, you know, like the maverick is like the way that we get around the problem of like, you know, So
Jessica Biel is the one who plays by all the rules. She's the risk assessment officer. She's the one that says you can't do this. So she's like the super ego thing. She's the woman. She's a wet blanket, all that.
Right. Which is her primary. This is her primary. Besides the fact that she is always wearing extremely low slung pants, that is her primary, like, you know, feminine quality, is that essentially she talks about ethics. I mean, while in the cockpit, I mean, it's a little weird to imagine that like there would be, you know, the way in which you would think that those ethical decisions would be taking place at the level of command, but how command works in the movie is actually like very confusing anyway, because really for the movie, it's not a problem that Josh Big Ben Gannon Lucas is a is a maverick, because that's the only way any of this makes sense is if you think that that's an important kind of figure. So like, you know, if the machine was actually just going to learn from him, that's what we want. But then we right. also don't want it at the same time, right? So it has to be struck by lightning, which fucks up its neural net, while possibly also like siphoning off what I assume is Josh Lucas's fairly limited palette of DNA possibilities into its own brain or whatever. And I think it's worth saying that one of the most funniest parts about this movie is that Eddie, EDI, the quantum computer slash plane, when it is removed from the plane, is just like a sphere with a lot of lights in it that then has like a stick that goes inside it. So it's like a sphere. And we learn right from the beginning. I mean, so like the hat is tipped to where this is going right at the beginning. We learn right from the beginning that for some reason, this stealth plane that really only needs this round ball to fly it also has a cockpit with a seat in it.
Yes.
So, you know, the real template for this movie is obviously Knight Rider.
Right.
And we know that also because Eddie's voice is like inescapably like that, like sort of quasi like English butler voice, like not as English as Kit's on Knight Rider, but like.
Right. It's got a cool.
Genteel American. Old yeah, money
exactly.
American.
Similarly. So we kind of know that really like ultimately its job is going to be the servant of like an appropriately masculine driver. It just hasn't figured it sort of like hasn't figured that part out.
It's
yet.
Got a cool calmness. I'm trying to Wentworth Miller played the voice. Who the fuck is Wentworth Miller?
He's a TV star.
He's that guy on that Prison Break show or whatever.
Yeah,
right?
Prison Break. And I think he's been on one of the WB superhero shows. The voice thing is also interesting because it's the whole upstairs downstairs staff across the board, because all the other AI is also a woman's voice. So we've got like,
yes,
the smartest AI is the butler, head of house, and then all the rest of the planes, the blimp, etc., they're all women's voices, but women's yeah, voice AI in that dull obvious, like at least Eddie has a little bit of acting to him. The female voices are all that dead Alexa voice.
Doesn't Ben's plane, doesn't he call her Betty at one point?
Probably.
Okay.
Probably.
This should also, it's also a pretty kind of a good moment to just mention that, okay, so this movie was directed by Rob Cohen, a man of somewhat sophisticated, not sophisticated, but interesting in, imagination. He was the producer of The Running Man. He directed Stealth. He's got a pretty XXX State of the Union. He's behind that franchise. He's got a pretty extensive kind of directing resume of, you know, pretty fairly middle brow, middle of the road junk. The writer of the film is W.D. Richter, who fans...
Ooh, inventor of the Richter scale?
Inventor of the Richter scale.
That's going right for it.
But who listeners may know from some of his other titles that he's written, namely in The Invasion of the Body Snatchers remake in 1978, starring Donald Sutherland. Big Trouble in Little China. He wrote Big Trouble in Little China. And he wrote, did he direct it?
He directed
Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension.
Oh.
So he's no slouch at all. He also wrote one of my favorite movies, which is Home for the Holidays, starring Holly Hunter. But that's a holiday movie. It has nothing to do with stealth or artificial intelligence. So, some kind of interesting mix of creative personalities in this fucking disaster movie.
I think it's just worth saying, just, you know, so that we don't have to go into too many details about this. This is also, like, to my mind, for the year 2005, like, I mean, I was just thinking, like, this is, I would not think that this movie was written by anyone who had a sense of humor of any kind. And for the year 2005, like, just like shockingly, it's racism and sexism is just like
jarring,
really regressive. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that this is not to say that the version of this movie, I mean, any version of this movie would be just like structurally like racist and sexist, but this one is just like, ew, like it's gross.
Proud of it. It's like super proud. It wants you to know.
I feel like I would attribute that to both Rob Cohen and to the kind of moment that the kind of radically regressive reactionary moment that it was made in, and the kind of like terror, like US like global empire war on terror kind of, you know, message that it has or whatever. But it is like, it is kind of very jarring, striking, right? Yeah. Like, for instance, when we see the three pilots in their individual quarters on the aircraft carrier reading about the EDI, you know, Josh Lucas is sort of reading about it. Jessica Biel is bouncing on a yoga ball while she's reading about it, highlighting it, very like, you know, goody two shoes, like Susie Goody Two Shoes or whatever. And Jamie Foxx is like dancing to rap music and pretending to be like photographed by paparazzi with his shirt off. And like, it's so, yeah. Jamie Foxx, who is like so much better than Josh Lucas, like clearly would be a way better lead in the film, but this film just can't imagine both either an interracial couple or like a leading black, you know, man, especially because, spoiler alert, he's going to be killed. And, you know, Josh Lucas is going to have to kind of avenge his, you know, wingman by taming Eddie or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, not to mention all the other racisms in it, which are like when they get to Thailand, which again, like, why the fuck are we in Thailand? This happens after they get back and the debrief, and like Eddie's neural net has been scrambled. And by the way, the tech guy who works on Eddie is on The Bear now, the show that's set in Chicago with that guy with the muscles. And it's very disturbing to see him 15 years younger. Maybe not disturbing, but it's kind of like, oh, that's that guy from The Bear. Anyway, his brain is scrambled. Keith Orbit is the guy who invented Eddie. He is in Seattle at a cool dinner party where they're talking about math. And a gorgeous Australian supermodel comes and tells him that George Cummings is on the phone and is pissed off because Eddie got struck by lightning or whatever. Keith Orbit is a name that's so atrocious that even the characters in the film question that that could possibly be his real name.
Yeah. Keith Orbit is one of the few, I mean, again, when you describe this movie, it sounds like it should be just like, it sounds like a comedy.
a parody, a Kubrick level satire.
Yeah, exactly. And yet it's like, just like really not. I think, Bill, you had some comment when we were talking about this about Jamie Foxx's cabin on the aircraft carrier, did you not?
Oh yes, they had they had really just landed on the aircraft carrier, and then when we're getting the little tour of their rooms, you know, we get a sort of three bears of internal decoration, like Josh Lucas hasn't done much, Jessica Biel has done like a normal amount of like standard suburban white girl goes to college decoration.
Yeah.
And then Jamie Foxx's room is just plastered with photos. So they've been on this ship a couple of hours, and he must have had his scotch tape in his cool fanny pack and then like 100 pictures of sexy ladies ready to tape up. And it's just like, I just imagine him like putting them up, and we're going to put you next to you. And then, and then 75 minutes later, we've got 100 pictures on the wall.
Well, she has on her wall put up like kids drawings. Like, presumably like her niece or nephew or something. Yeah. Plus like all of her lingerie hanging up, which she's hand washed, right? Clearly, because in the military, you as a woman, you need like sexy lingerie.
You definitely wear lingerie.
Yeah, especially when you're one of the most elite pilots in the world.
The more that I think about it, the more like the weakness of the relationship between Jessica Biel and Josh Lucas, which is just like it barely gets off the ground. And then it's like it's just floppy. It really is like a classic homosocial desire plot. Like it's really just Josh and Eddie, like really drawn to each other at this tense odds, but just like, oh, I gotta get with you. And then we crash, we kill the black man, crash the lady, and then finally they can all get together.
They can reconcile. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's
they can consummate their relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Which just to sort of, kind of, I think, seal the deal on that one. There's something that goes underexplained, I would say, is like, so we have that seat in the cockpit ready for Josh Lucas to take it once he has finally taken control of Kit, the Knight Rider car, and can ride it to go, or his like horse, the Mustang that he's now tamed, or like the dog or whatever it is. And, you know, take it to go rescue Jessica Biel. But like, of course, this, you know, leaves open, at least initially for us, the question of what is he planning to do with Jessica Biel once he gets to North Korea? Is he going to like squeeze her into the cockpit too? It's obvious that she's not going to fit in. I mean, the problem is solved in another way, which is that Eddie gets blown up. But, you know,
and
yeah.
Luckily,
I mean,
they're right at the border of South Korea, so everything's going to be fine. And they kill all the North Koreans.
After they kill all of the North Koreans. Yeah, I mean, the sort of like the tourism part of it, you know, going to Thailand, which basically seems like, you know, is represented as a place for like sex tourism, like the portrayal. I mean, Jamie Foxx must have like really needed money to take this role. I like don't understand it. Like he's like, you know, just like this terrible stereotype, you know. I mean, and Joe Morton and Sam Shepard are also both much too good for the movie in ways that cause like a certain amount of dissonance whenever they're on screen, but like those roles are not nearly, I mean, you know, I can imagine you reading this role and being like, oh, fine, whatever, I'll do it. Whereas I just can't imagine Jamie Foxx reading this role and being like, yeah, that sounds appropriate to me.
He made this after Ray, which he won the best acting Oscar for.
I think they thought this movie was going to be huge. So I sort of assume that these folks must have gotten, I mean, the money went to like a few actors and a whole lot of special effects. It's what was it, a budget of $135 million in 2004, and then it made about 80.
This is after Ray and after Collateral for Jamie Foxx. Yeah. This is clearly just military propaganda. Like, there's no two ways about it. Like, the military gave them deals and like really focused on, helped it with the promotion and stuff like that. I mean, you don't get to use aircraft carriers or mention the military at all unless you have full cooperation, meaningful directorship by the military, probably.
Right,
you
right.
Know, like they had final say on the script, which probably accounts for a lot of its deficiencies. Maybe not its racisms, but it's like deficiencies for sure. I mean, just speaking again, like of how kind of, I don't know, like regressive, bankrupt, and kind of declension, what am I trying to say? Decadent this movie is in terms of like the decay of empire and its imagination. Sam Shepard and Ben, George and Ben, after the mission, they play a game in the in his conference room, not of chess, which you would expect, but Scrabble. They're playing Scrabble.
I mean,
Ben is offered a cigar, quote, rolled on the thighs of mulatto women.
My God. I mean, what is that line even doing in there?
And I mean, it just shows how, you know, foreshadows how George is a bad guy because he's explicitly racist instead of just like matter of, you know, like incidentally racist.
Well, now we've gotten to the most
green apples instead of red apples.
Well, I was just going to say, now we've gotten to the most important part of the movie, which is in that scene, there is not just one overflowing bowl. So first of all, I just like the fantasy about what when you are like a military commander, what your like office suite looks like is hilariously funny.
On an aircraft carrier. Yeah.
On an aircraft carrier. It's like he's basically like in some like, you know, downtown Toronto, like, you know, high-end studio apartment that like, you know, executives stay in when they're in town for a conference or something like that. But like he has not one, but two overflowing bowls of green apples in that room. And that, then later in the scene when he, not that this spoils anything at all, ends up shooting himself, he also right. has a giant overflowing bowl of green apples, and that's in a different room.
Yeah.
So what the fuck? What's going on with that?
It's got to be a secret message to somebody that the CIA is putting in the film, I think.
Maybe it's Sam Shepard just finding a way to deal with the tedium of this movie by telling Rob Cohen, you know what Cummings would have? He'd have a big bowl of green apples full all the time.
Gives him
just
something
green
to
apples
do.
Everywhere.
Gives him some action to do, something to yeah. play with. The other thing that about George Cummings, Sam Shepard's character, is that he's on the phone frequently with a shadowy Washington D.C. Well, figure, mm-hmm. like a. I felt like it was a senator or something. I'm not yeah. sure if he calls him senator at a certain point, but that also like kind of foreshadows how he's kind of shady and not fully. To be trusted. But in that scene with Josh Lucas, they also have I don't know if it's the first, but one of the first discussions about the kind of ethics that they're having here. Like, you know, Josh Lucas is opposed to Eddie because humans have instincts, feelings, moral judgment. These things shouldn't be left up to machines. War isn't some kind of video game. Actions shouldn't be divorced from the consequences. And it's just kind of interesting to kind of speculate and sit back and wonder what kind of moral education is required for these, let me check my notes, fighter pilots to accomplish before they are given the keys to a all-destructive, the power of God to drop nuclear or whatever kind of weapons on like unsuspecting people all over the world. Which, by the way, they fly all over the world.
They fly all over the fucking world.
Quickly, yeah. Like instantaneously.
Very impressive.
And the most science fiction-y moment, I think this is maybe my favorite detail in the film. The most science fiction-y moment is the like refueling dirigible that's just yeah. one of, I assume, multiple of these that are just constantly floating over the earth somewhere. So you're able to make this, I mean, it's a story point in a couple of ways, obviously, because we get the great scene of its explosion, but also the fact that it makes possible all this international jetting around, that you can just go to this automated refueling station, get yourself going, and then go bomb someone else until you have to go back to the aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's known as a, according to Wikipedia, a HAP.
Wait, it's a real thing?
Well, not in the form that we see it in this movie, but there are some kinds of geostationary HAPs, I believe.
High altitude
airships, camel humps used for yeah. aerial refueling.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely wild. I had no idea.
It looks very cool. Yeah, and it doesn't surprise me that these are geostationary, like constantly up there almost all the time.
I mean, it's a little confusing. Amazing. Based on my reading of that Wikipedia article, it's a little confusing to me to what degree these are real things versus not real things, but you know,
considering the fact that we have like, you know, that we have had like manned B-1 bombers or bombers at all times flying around the world ready at a moment's notice to drop nuclear bombs on the Soviet Union for decades, it doesn't surprise me that we would have
HAPs
refueling yeah. stations. Yeah.
So, well, the other strain, just what, because you brought up the senator who Sam Shepard talks with. I mean, the other strain in the movie that is, again, like sort of not reconciled, but is part of how it sort of tries to maintain its like military code of honor purity. Right. Because like, I do think something that the movie does not want to seem to be, I think that like it sort of wants to be like, you know, this is about like our highly trained, highly skilled, extremely brave, you know, men and women in uniform, mostly men in uniform. And are extremely well-developed and thoughtful technology. But it is not about the aspect of our extremely well-developed and thoughtful technology that is just like drone bombing the shit out of people, right? This is all, so this is all this kind of like argument for something being manned, right? I mean, that's like,
well, this is another, another great reason why Kara would be a risk assessment officer and be able to call off a mission at the moment of them doing it, because only by being so close and like a human being with moral judgment, only by having that happen could you actually be close enough to say whether it's okay or not to murder many hundreds of people at once.
Right, exactly. And the other strain of it is that there is this kind of like deep state thing also that's going on, right? That seems to be the Sam Shepard character's connection to whoever this senator, the shadowy senator, who is then in turn connected to a facility in Alaska that I've got to say goes extremely underexplained.
Yeah.
Where Josh Lucas, who after, you know, everything's gone to shit and like Kara has been shot down and had to parachute into North Korea, where a false and duplicitous adorable child betrays her by screaming, et cetera. And Josh Lucas has also been hurt and he has to fly to this installation in Alaska that we hear really nothing about. And then a very suspicious man who clearly is not a doctor is like, let me just give you a little injection from a bottle that simply says serum on it.
Serum.
But that whole site, which Josh Lucas will then just like essentially just like bomb the shit out of and kill everybody there, seems to be some kind of deep state, like, but also like somehow public private site in Alaska.
Well, and also it's some kind of black site torture site. I mean, there's that whole wall of torture equipment as well as all the, it's like a Guantanamo in Alaska, but apparently not with any, you know, we got people in and out for rendition, but we don't keep them here.
Yeah, it's illegitimate Guantanamo because it's not run by the legitimate, military and the CIA, but instead this like shadowy deep state.
Yeah,
George or something.
George tells Ben he directs Ben and Eddie after they become reconciled, which is there's so many details. George directs them to the Brooks Range in Alaska, where a private corporation's secure facilities, manned by civilians who will be, quote, prepared and very helpful with tech support for the UCAV. And Ben just accepts this, with no questions asked, except for that he and Eddie do detect tension in George's voice, which shows that he's lying about Kara being safe. But like he's like, oh, a private company is going to let me like land this like hyper experimental super secret VLO stealth extreme deep invader unmanned combat aerial vehicle there, and they're going to help us fix it. That sounds fine. Nothing wrong with that.
So that
this was before Blackwater changed its name.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. It's very unclear. Like, it's basically like, so the guys there look kind of mad. And like a number of them are wearing like kind of Carhartt style jackets. So I don't really know what we're supposed to make of them. So they don't have the military contractor look, which I feel like is normally signaled by, for some reason, wearing a keffiyeh and having a beard, which these guys, a la special forces. So I don't know who these guys are supposed to be. And Keith, sorry, Orbit. It's not Keith Urban. What is his name?
Keith Orbit.
Keith Moon.
Keith Orbit is there too, but they're also trying to kill him. So it's not Keith Orbit's company. Anyway, that part is confusing. But the best part of the movie comes right before that, which is the reconciliation.
Right.
What do you call the part of the romance where they finally, like, they haven't gotten together yet, but they've admitted that they love each other.
This is where Ben and Eddie's relationship, I mean, is he the Knight Rider car? Is he a horse? Is he a talking gun? What is Eddie? This is where Eddie is most like a wolf that Ben is trying to tame.
Yes.
Because Eddie has learned, or a hyper-intelligent wolf that Ben is, because Eddie has learned from Ben that you have to be a maverick in order to accomplish your mission. And at a certain point, Eddie starts giving himself his own orders. Like, they're given another mission where they have to bomb basically like a castle in Tajikistan, because this warlord has some Scud missiles, and it turns out he also has nuclear warheads. Again, Kara, the risk assessment officer, says, no, we can't bomb them, because if the nukes go off, radioactive dust is going to like wash over all these farmers, and they're going to die of radiation sickness and be horrible. Eddie's like, no, fuck that. I'm going to do it anyway. And he, you know, he goes ahead, he bombs them. The three other Talons have to go in and, like, you know, protect Eddie from, you know, whatever, for, you know, be their wingman. Eddie ends up flying in such a way that it, you know, he outfoxes Jamie Foxx, who flies into a mountain and dies. But Eddie is also got some sort of shrapnel damage or whatever, and he's going to start picking his own targets out of a list that he's been programmed with. But before he can do that, And so then Ben has to go like chasing him or whatever. Kara's plane is damaged. She's sort of returning. It ends up sort of crashing over North Korea. Ben is chasing Eddie, catches up with him, trying to convince him. I mean, they're both like just trying to convince Eddie to follow orders and go back to the, which is like, I don't understand how you do that. Like, or why you couldn't just type in he's a robot. So, but Eddie is damaged. So, and he's on fire. And he's about to crash. And so so Ben is like, Eddie, you know, do you trust me or whatever? They fly down close to the ocean. Ben instructs Eddie to fall back a little bit. Ben drops a bomb under the ocean. It explodes. Water flies up. Eddie flies through the water, and it puts out the fire that is threatening to make Eddie crash. So now Eddie now trusts Ben. Now they have earned, he has earned his trust, much like removing the proverbial splinter from the proverbial lion's proverbial paw.
Exactly.
It's Aesop style.
A moment of kinship and care. Mm. Now, the whole thing about the quote unquote nuclear dust that gets dropped.
Oh, they're fucked. I mean, nuclear dust.
Yeah, we get clear indication in the movie that they're all going to die, and the village is toast and dead, and that's the end of the conversation.
And this makes, actually, incidentally, this makes Henry very upset because of the native Thai girl that he had sex with, who did not speak English, but with whom he shared an idea about, like, this is such beautiful country, and when you're up there, you're thinking about, oh, how beautiful it is. But then you're also, oh, I'm dropping bombs on it. So this really weird, like, post-Vietnam kind of, like, you know, guilt about, like, murdering, like, peasant farmers, but you're trained to do it, and hopefully it's good for the world or some bullshit. Anyway, like, seeing the nuclear dust engulf the village makes Henry very upset and makes him determined not to destroy Eddie, but to convince him to, you know, come back.
Right. To act rationally.
To act rationally.
I mean, the dropping the bomb into the water, I thought it was a lake and not the ocean, but either way.
Oh, it might be a lake. Who knows?
Like, I don't know. Again, there's nothing, you know, it's impossible in this kind of scene to have any sort of thought about, like, the consequences of anything, even though the idea of consequence as this, like, moral problem is constantly being raised.
Right.
And, like, those moments are particularly weird, because one thing that is notable about this movie is that the globe, you know, the planet turns out to be actually very small, and not in a, like, metaphorical, just like literally, apparently things are very close to each other and arranged. You know, there's a kind of like whole, like, you know, I don't know, continental drift or something has happened, and like things are really arranged in a very different way. But despite the fact that everything is very close together, which is how somehow Jessica Biel is, like, you know, having to parachute into North Korea
when they were just over Tajikistan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Despite that extreme closeness of everything, like there is no sense of anything that like crosses over borders or has any kind of like impact that like radiates sort of way. Not that you would expect the movie to have this, but it's just like another like really confusing thing about like what sort of world are we supposed to think that this is?
This is exactly the way in which this is a Western, but the frontier is the entire world. And like the various Indian tribes are, Native American tribes are alternately potentially helpful, hostile, whatever, but that it's a kind of borderless. And everything, the borderlessness makes it all just very confusing. So we were over Tajikistan. Now suddenly we're over Russia and there are three Russian airplanes after us. And we're going to have to crash those because it, like Ben and Eddie are going to have to blow up the Russian planes because they are, at least are American and they have to look out for each other because they're wingmen. And, you know, damn the consequences of blowing up three Russian planes, which yes, then we would be in nuclear war and there would be no,
no more Russian problems
after that. I should mention too, that Henry was trying to destroy Eddie after the nuclear blast. Like he shot missiles at him and then Eddie outmaneuvered him and forced him to kind of fly into a mountain. So there was this kind of like order to terminate Eddie basically.
A scene I will point out we saw echoed in Prometheus, that slow motion crash of the cockpit of the ship into the stationary object.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the coolest sort of scene is the refueling blimp thing where Eddie has to sort of shoot out the nozzle so that it's just leaking fuel everywhere, and because he's such a great pilot, he can kind of position his own sort of nozzle into the hose to siphon off the fuel. But then the fuel is like in a circle of fuel around the blimp. And then when Ben comes up to refuel, he and Eddie have this kind of dialogue scene where Eddie is like, no, I'm, you know, following my own orders now. You can't tell me what to do. There's very much of a teen angst quality to Eddie, where he's listening to Incubus really loud and he turns up the volume to drown out his parents giving him orders and telling him what to do. He like lights the fuel on fire and, you know, Josh Lucas flies out just in the nick of time. And then we see like from outer space, the explosion of the blimp. And it's like a nuclear, like a mushroom cloud size, like nuclear event in the atmosphere, which can't be good, you would think.
So much environmental damage in this movie. So we get the nuclear dust. We've blown up a lake and wrecked a small chunk of this ecosystem. There's been a huge fuel explosion up in space that's going to clearly rain down all kinds of toxic chemicals, as well as all the pieces of our HAP vehicle up there.
The missile strike in Myanmar as he flies over like direct, like a, you know, very fast airplane right over like downtown traffic in Rangoon. And then also when he flies into South Korea below the radar, he flies over like these thatched huts and like these tile roofs of this village and just rips the roofs right off of them. Just horrific kind of like incidental violence that just goes completely on. And then when they're escaping from the hangar in Alaska, they shoot a missile out of Eddie and it blows the doors up and just like completely annihilates all these mercenaries that's like kind of some of the most gruesome like deaths, I would say. And because they're mercenaries and they were trying to kill them directly, like it's okay. Like they're bad. They're like explicitly coded as bad guys, other than the North Korean like military guys who are pursuing Kara and eventually Ben. Like they get essentially napalmed, and that kind of that head, that kind of like leader of that group who has a mohawk. I mean, this is like makes it like explicitly a Western. Like he is like a Native American, like hyper, you know, competent warrior with a mohawk hairstyle. When he dies, he gets blown up somehow and back into like a chain link barbed wire fence and just sort of hangs there from the fence. I mean, it's like so gruesome.
In the coiled barbed wire.
It's coiled barbed wire.
Yeah. The only places we get those lingering death shots are in the camera, like really, really wants to show you that is in his shot. But yeah, as you said, the explosion scene, we see bodies just tossed and mangled there. And it's clear we're supposed to be just loving that these torturers got blowed up in slow-mo.
When the hyper
don't know who they are, by the way. There's nothing. I mean, there's nothing.
They have no identity. They don't. No. When they speak to each other, we don't even get I don't think we get subtitles or anything like that. Like they have no names either. Like the North Korean,
Not just the North Koreans, but also the guys in Alaska too.
Oh yeah, the guys in Alaska.
We're supposed to also. I mean, the North Korean one is clearly worse. I mean, all of those scenes are so bizarre.
Yeah. Quasi-feral, but yeah, the white guys in Alaska are just kind of menacingly, evil or bully, bullies or something.
Yeah,
but they
exactly.
Are mercs, I guess.
Yeah. But we know so little about them that it's hard to understand what is meant to justify us watching I don't know. It is quite extended. All of these bodies falling one after another in this big.
Well, of course, it's explosion. Their deaths are contrasted with the hyper competence of the three minus one, plus one heroes. Where the North Korean Mohawk warrior, he shoots Jessica Biel in the shoulder with a high-powered rifle from a million miles away, an insane, hyper-competent shot. But then when they get close to her, she's kind of hiding out and she just takes a machine gun and flails it around and just shoots randomly. And 10 of them fall down and die. And then she does the exact same thing when they're at the border. She shoots the guard tower and they all fall back and die. She's not even aiming at them. And it's remarkable too, because you wouldn't really expect her to have much weapons training as a fighter pilot person. She's not there for her marksmanship, right? She's there because she can fly this plane with great competence or whatever. And technical, savvy.
It really I feel like this is a movie where it's kind of the incoherence of it is actually is quite disturbing in some ways, it's not, I don't think it doesn't do a good job of being any of the things that it kind of imagines that it could be. And it definitely doesn't do a good job concentrating on the whole supposed problem of AI. I mean,
that just goes out the window, really.
Which basically goes out the window. Except that then we're supposed to, I actually didn't see this, but because I read the Wikipedia article afterwards, I know that happens. Post credits, Eddie gets blown up in the demilitarized zone in North
Korea. Well, he sacrifices himself.
Sacrifices itself in order to save. Oh, because of the best moment, which happens before that, I guess while they're still in Alaska and he's talking, Eddie and Keith Urban are having a conversation. Keith Orbit. And Eddie says, "I cannot change the data. My neural network shows patterns I do not recognize." To which Keith Urban responds, "My God, you mean... you feel." It's just the set of incredibly conventional beats about what a robot is kind of amazing. But then the movie has completely lost track of this whole thing. And then post credits, after Eddie has been blown up, we see the little lights coming on again in the remainder of its little spearhead or whatever.
Oh, really?
Did you not watch post credits?
Wow. I guess I stopped it.
Never seen that.
Yeah, wow. Well, that's
it was
funny.
Opening it up for a sequel where North Korea got its hands on Knight Rider and
that's right. Exactly.
Well, what in Knight Rider we had Kit and Carr, K-A-R-R.
Yeah.
And that this would have set up a great sequel.
Exactly.
That's such a great that robot puberty moment is always delightful in a film, but it's especially good in this one when he's telling Keith Urban, I'm seeing patterns I've never had. There's hair in places under my wings that I didn't have it before.
Which also fits actually quite well with an early moment when, for some reason, we have to have like a conversation about like what the right pronouns for Eddie are.
Right.
What's his name? Ben Lucas.
Big Ben. Ben Gannon.
Big Ben.
Ben Gannon.
Big Ben Gannon.
Gannon the Cannon.
Ben
Cannon.
Big,
another
Ben,
another much better call sign.
Yeah, really. He says, referring to Eddie, I'll call it a he when it gets out of its cockpit and takes a piss.
Oh.
Which is a strange, I mean, actually, that's a very strange take on, I would suppose, like, you know, masculinity. Mostly about pissing.
It's true, yeah, because women do pee.
Yeah, you might think.
I've noticed this.
Yeah, but Jennifer Beale obviously pees in the cockpit, which is how you know that she's a woman.
But the feeling thing is like, you know, that's been the crux of the argument against AI, is that humans have feelings, they have moral sentiment, and therefore they can make informed decisions about, you know, shared humanity or whatever, and which are the deserving people to blow off the face of the earth with massive military hardware.
And what we learn is that when Eddie starts feeling, what his insight is that he should kill himself.
Yeah, well, he has to sacrifice himself by flying, you know, directly into a helicopter that is menacing Ben and Kara as they limp their way to the into the demilitarized zone between North and South Koreas.
Which then, oddly enough, the last thing that we hear the Sam Shepard character say is he gets on the phone to the senator, and this time the senator, after Joe Morton is like,
yeah,
the jig's up, baby. We know you're yeah. a dirty cop or whatever.
And the classic Joe Morton, Captain Dick Marshfield, arrests George and then does something that is always allowed, which is gives him a minute to go to the bathroom by himself. While he's just sitting there in the dark wearing sunglasses.
Well, in the bathroom, he happens to have his sat phone with him. Because I would also keep that in the bathroom. Obviously.
You keep in your dop kit, your razor, your toothbrush, your toothpaste, your sat phone, your small pistol.
Exactly. And he calls the senator, and this time the senator won't take his call. So we know that the real bad people are the senators, but that's confusing because also, anyway. But so the senator won't take his call, and Sam Shepard says... Leaves a voicemail in which he says,
which in 2004, the senator is listening to while he leaves the voicemail.
So it's on his answering machine. And
his tape-based answering machine,
which is part of the whole, this film's like conception of like what period it takes place in. I mean, yeah, it's a war on terror film, but it kind of seems like it thinks it's a Vietnam film, you know, like
it's an 80s film.
It's definitely an 80s film. I mean, I guess most movies are 80s movies at this point, but and he says, so by the time you hear what you'll hear, he makes a big like drama out of the fact that obviously like the pistol shot is going to be recorded. But when you hear this, you'll know what the difference is between a warrior and a politician. And apparently the difference between a warrior and a politician is that a warrior would shoot himself in the bathroom.
Right.
Whereas a politician wouldn't, which I find strange, but odd convergence there between Eddie and Sam Shepard, who is, you know, the bad guy, but he's noble. And Eddie also learns to be a person by learning you have to be willing to kill yourself, because that like takes care of the problem, right?
Yeah.
Of having artificial intelligence if it's willing to like self-sacrifice.
That's an interesting, that is an interesting parallel.
Yeah. Thanks. I just thought of it now.
No, that is, yeah. But of course, they're like, it's a contrast because, you know, Eddie is sacrificing himself for the good of his two best friends.
Right.
And George is doing it because he's actually a coward.
Right. Right.
So, well, you know, I think that's interesting, though. Like, I was just thinking, like, it's what it does is it proves to us that Eddie is really a warrior, which I think, if I remember the Wikipedia page, was the original name for the screenplay back in 2002. So that's I wonder if that's a lingering moment to, like, really reaffirm that. However, I mean, as Hillary said, like, Sam Shepard is given a certain kind of nobility in his exit, despite the darkness of his soul. Yeah, and that we see that Eddie is like Sam Shepard in this moment.
I mean, clearly in the end, the project of the movie is to say, like, we should just accept that the military has all this hardware, you know, which much of it in this movie is fantasy, but we should just simply accept that, right? Because like, there's something good about, like, a, you know, like a warrior culture or whatever it is. I mean, obviously Eddie also has to get out of the way because, as it turns out, you know, he's gotten himself, he thought he was finding, like, his master, his one true friend, his bestie. But it turns out he was just, like, in a homosocial relationship, and he's got to get out of that because he has to make room for Josh Lucas and Jessica Biel to get together in a supremely awkward scene that takes place after Jamie Foxx's funeral. And my last note on my sheet of notes just says, where did they get that giant photo of Jamie Foxx? The funeral scene on the aircraft carrier. It's just like this poster sized photo of him on an easel. Like, would you just have that? Do they have one of those for everybody in case
Josh Lucas is over at Kinko's being like, can you take this picture and get it, like, this big on foam core for me?
Like, isn't it like 12 feet tall or something? They must have a giant printer on the aircraft carrier, right? Because the military just has equipment. Like, they just use it. Ben, when Eddie dies, Ben, like, almost comes close to saluting the plane as it's exploding. Yeah. Like, he looks back. So then they're back on the aircraft carrier, Henry's funeral. And then it's just, you know, we're just back down to Ben and Kara, and he makes a big speech. He says something, you know, we're two, which is a prime number, which makes it lucky, and we're lucky. And then Kara says, just tell me you love me, you pussy. And then that's the end of the movie.
Yep.
Hilarious. Which sucks. I mean, like, this is a movie that I feel like part of the script was written, it feels like the script, like, going back to the 80s, like, it feels like there's definitely, like, ideas in here that Richter, the writer, could have done something more interesting with in, like, a 1980s context or something, like, just more interesting actors and better delivery of dialogue would actually make this movie a lot more watchable. But in the age of, like, in this kind of global war on terror moment with, like, hyper militarized special effects and just kind of extraordinarily generic stars with nothing to kind of differentiate themselves from any number of other potential actors, it's just like junk. Just like there's a lot less interesting things to unpack here. Like, I feel like if Freudian psychology was more robust in the early 2000s than it would, like, more robust when it was made versus when it was written, or when in other moments that it could have been made, like in the 70s or 60s or 50s, we could have had a lot more kind of clever dialogue or interesting things. But there's really just nothing going on in terms of the sexual dynamics between the love triangles between the characters are so sanitized in a way. They just, like, you can't really even imagine, you know, what they would do to each other if they were together alone and naked. They would probably just, like, sort of stand and pose in front of each other rather than actually touch each other physically. And I think maybe, like, one thing that, like, kind of may perhaps drives that home is the ball that Eddie is. He's just this orb. There's no orifices, or there's no Cronenbergian, like, fleshiness to it. It's just a kind of, like, smooth giant marble sexless kind of ball that has no kind of, again, charisma or appeal at all.
Blue when it's relaxed, it's red when it's angry. The end. Yeah.
I did learn from the from reading the Wikipedia article that so it was filmed in or it was produced at studios in Australia, and there's like some location filming which seems to be largely Australia and New Zealand, and apparently they wanted to film in a wilderness area in Blue Mountains National Park in New South Wales, Australia, where a community legal center specializing in environmental law brought a suit against them to stop the stop the filming. And indeed, the judge sided with the Conservation Society, and I'm quoting the Wikipedia article now, said it was completely against the intended use of the land, concluding his judgments with the words, "Wilderness is sacrosanct."
Oh my God.
Hilarious. I mean, which maybe that like drive, maybe the film has actually a real animus against the proposal that wilderness is sacrosanct, and that actually might hold the whole thing together. Its obsession, it's a weird vision of like a global peasantry. Its idea that everything is very close together, its sense that like it's possible to like produce a nuclear explosion in one area that doesn't go anywhere other than like 30 feet away from the random castle that the nuclear explosion took place at, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But
There's nothing sacred in this film.
Absolutely.
No.
But not in a fun way.
An additional environmental note is that in the IMDb trivia, it says that the Alaska airfield explosion sequence used 500 gallons of gasoline and was so big that NASA had to be notified in advance, which I almost can imagine that it being the case that Rob Cohen was so excited about having to tell NASA about blowing up so much gasoline that they added the space shot to the gas hap blowing up in space
possibly
because screw the wilderness.
I mean, my, you know, one of my biggest problems with the film was that if Eddie indeed downloads all the music in the world and listens to all of it and picks his favorite, and he's a hyper intelligent robot, why Incubus? Makes no sense.
I think that's a great question.
I think you hit it with the angsty teen. I mean, I was also looking at the soundtrack listing. There's four Incubus songs on the soundtrack as well.
It's angsty teen. And also I couldn't help but notice that by the end, when Ben gets into the cockpit and they finally are united, Ben's wearing like a t-shirt with over a Henley with like cargo pant, long cargo pants.
Yeah.
It's just like classic, like skateboarder punk kind of like suburban kid wear. And hard to get past that sort of
but image. You know, I think Matt, you said earlier, like, I mean, I guess we were all talking about who's this movie for, and I think this is like all the various problems with this movie. It's like a zero quadrant movie. Like, you have to like dumb robot movies and airplane, you know, and military jet movies to be into this. It's not for the Incubus listening teen. It's like sort of for the Tom Clancy dad, but ultimately it's too dumb for the Tom Clancy dad. It's not a date movie because the relationships are so completely sterile. Like it isn't for anybody.
It's a military propaganda vehicle. I mean, it's kind of, that's all.
But it's even bad at that because like it's unclear like where the sympathetic military really is because we get Sam Shepard as both the heavy and the sympathetic guy. We get Josh Lucas's, he's a maverick, but he's also like ultimately a rule follower. So he's both things, but then like the rules he's actually following aren't attached to any characters. There's no, like he's attached to like the good part of the military, but who is that?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a great point, right? Like the propaganda aspect is not actually allegiance to even the nation of the United States of America. And it can't be to the army or to the armed services because nearly all of your commanding officers are themselves corrupt and in bed with like corrupt politicians who are cowardly, who we never actually see face to face. They're always behind literally like behind closed doors and like in shadowy offices that we are never, we always see the, that guy from the windows outside the building rather than inside close up. So there's just these shadowy forces. And as a good person, you're just meant to have moral rectitude that you can then follow and in order to execute the, but only execute the orders that you deem fit at the specific moment. So there's no higher authority that you're giving yourself to in the name of the nation or anything like that. There's just only your own in the moment, immediate kind of concerns and judgments about like what is right and wrong.
Which I think
Michael Bay always gives you the clarity on what you're supposed to believe, what you're supposed to believe in, to a lesser extent, Peter Berg, like they get ideology programming right. This is filled with ideology, but it's incoherent and as fragmented as poor Eddie's brain after a lightning strike.
And here's too where Rob Cohen directed the first Fast and Furious, but after that, he wasn't really involved in it. I don't even know that he's a producer on Fast and Furious. And like, I haven't seen all the Fast and Furious movies, but at least the ideology there coheres around parts three or four, I think, around the concept of family, right? This is like family. And there's a kind of like, it's a transnational, transracial family. We're family because we work together and we look out for each other. But that the cohering thing, is, and it's not a kind of blood family necessary. Like there is, there are blood relations within it, but if you are, you know, with us and on our team and of the good, then you are family. And we do this thing for family. We have like this, this commensal family. We eat together and we like fight together and we play together. That's absent from here. So like Rob, that's not part of Rob Cohen's Fast and Furious universe. Mm-hmm. And it's absent here from Stealth as well. Like there's this kind of like, there's just nothing there cohering these people other than kind of a diffused ideology that's what's supposed to happen in a movie or something.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't even manage to do the like a kind of standard, you know, a sort of standard thing in movies of this kind, which is to be like, oh, the commanders are bad, but like the grunts on the ground are good, you know, that's or, you know, there's this corrupt part of the chain of command, but then there's also the uncorrupt part of the chain of command or what, you know, whatever it is like, you know, I think it kind of thinks that's the universe that it's in, but it's not really in that universe. But it is maybe, you know, like useful to just think that like, you know, given that this movie was made like in cooperation with like multiple sort of branches of the military and the Defense Department, I guess, you know, that it doesn't like, it's a good lesson perhaps in like what that money is for is not for like ideological coherence, which, you know, like ideological reproduction just can happen like all over the place. That money is simply for like, you know, the display of weaponry of various like mostly fantasized kinds, you know, and that I think like, and it doesn't matter that like, presumably like the script was indeed vetted by like multiple people from the government. And it doesn't matter that like it actually seems to cast, you know, like that it doesn't have like any sense of like mission. It is not, in fact, you know, clearly about the war on terror in any way. I think all that matters is this idea of like, you know, one, the sort of recruitment piece of like, look, you can wear these like uniforms that fit you really well and good looking people like do this job, you know, which I feel like that's got to be weak. I mean, does that really work on anybody? I mean, maybe
and you get
does.
To go all over the world. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, no, it's not meant to work on the people that actually enlist in the military. It's meant to work on the people who accept the fact that young people enlist in the military.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other thing is just like a kind of like fantasy about like hardware, you know, like it's not actually true that like all kinds of like, you know, new and much hyped like, you know, pieces of military hardware don't work right and just like blow themselves up because like they're not, or, you know, like can't fly in the rain or whatever it is. Like, you know, because actually, like, the military is on the cutting edge of what blah, 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 you know, and it knows nothing about what the cutting edge is. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that it's stupid. It doesn't matter that none of this stuff, like, makes any sense. It is just, like, the idea of, like, a kind of, like, You know, this is the locus of these like really advanced tools. And oh, by the way, also we can see everything that's happening all the time. Yeah. This is the other, you know, like, you know, but, I mean, but that stuff is like, I think it's like not even like in the, it doesn't even operate like ideologically. It just like is this very like blunt kind of, you know, propagandistic thing. Cause like that plane looks fucking dumb. I mean, like it doesn't look, you know, like
it didn't sell any toys. No.
No, I mean, nobody wants this shit.
I think that's a really good point that the point isn't, you know, the point of the propaganda isn't that all the stuff works because we know that it doesn't work, but the fact that it just exists. And also, yeah, that, like you said, like there's no coherent military ideology or kind of like patriotic thing or like even like or opposition to the deep state or acceptance of the military industrial complex as a kind of, you know, necessary thing. The idea behind it is, this stuff exists and it needs to continue to exist, whether it works or not, or what, for whatever reason that is being deployed. And like its mere existence and presence in the world is what's being sort of propagandized here. And it's kind of like matter of factness, like the naturalness that it actually, that all this stuff actually just is there. Right. And people are working on it and making more of it, again, whether it works or not, no matter how much it costs, et cetera, et cetera.
And I mean, and it might make you wonder why, like, somebody like Peter Berg works so fucking hard on, like, making, like, on ideology, you know what I mean? Like, on, like, I mean, so that, those movies then, I've been watching, like, a lot of Peter Berg movies lately, and they're truly horrifying.
Why are you doing that to yourself?
I don't know. I've like, been on an ideology kick lately. I've been trying to think about ideology again, like, why it doesn't seem as important to me as a category or as a, you know, an organizing structure as I used to think that it was. And it is, it, you know, it is kind of fascinating to watch, like, it is kind of fascinating to watch these movies. I mean, I found I could not watch, as I already told Bill, I could not watch the Peter Berg Boston Marathon bombing movie because, as it turns out, Peter Berg plus Boston accents is just like a bridge too far for me. And I, like, 15 minutes in, I was like, this movie will literally kill me if I have to watch the whole thing. So I didn't watch that, but Patriots Day. But like those movies, you know, like, so there's something else also that's happening in those movies, you know, something that is like, something that actually can show up when you look at a movie like this, you know, that presumably is basically produced by the military, then I suppose you have to have a, like a somewhat different thought about like what's happening in like the sort of Peter Berg obsession with that sort of like classic, like the grunts are right, the people who are in charge are wrong, yet somehow the United States is also like right. You know, both movies have to be underpinned with like a very particular version of like, you know, what race and gender relations are. But like this movie, like Self doesn't do any kind of work around that. I mean, maybe this is why it's like a box office failure too. It was like a huge failure at the box office. And maybe that's because like it's unsatisfying, you know, but maybe it's also just because like, yeah, Josh Lucas was not a great lead. You know, he's not,
I think that has a lot to do with it actually.
He's not compelling. You know, Jessica Biel looks like a child. It's like depressing. I mean, her just like very like, you know, completely like untouched by time face is like kind of depressing also. I don't know. Anyway, whatever.
Maybe maybe she did the crayon drawing in her papers.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Well, anyway. I look forward to watching this movie again in 8 to 12 months by myself and telling you how it stands up on multiple rewatches.
Oh, it's
I look forward to never seeing it again. Pay attention to the post credit sequence this time, Bill.
Yeah, I know. Really, I
knew. Who knew? Although, also having fast forwarded to ahead to see the post credit thing, it's like it's pretty disappointing.
I would imagine
it's just like one light goes on. You know,
disappointing in this movie. Get out!
I know, it's hard to imagine.
I mean, that really fits, right? Like a post-credit sequence that's just like, meh.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, a weak gesture.
I guess I'm still here. Yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed talking about this with you guys, despite the fact that
love it going to the movies with you all.
Yes, It would have been really, I would have completely enjoyed seeing this in a movie theater with you two.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Watching it at home, it was a little bit more of a chore.
Real slog. I mean, when, again, Incubus, when that comes back on, I'm just like, oh my God, it just cringe. I just felt so embarrassed for 2004.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you again, Bill. Not really suggesting this, for turning us on to it. And then, you know, I apologize for subjecting you and our listeners to this conversation, but go out and see Stealth.
Anytime.
I think I do feel like since our last episode was on Everything for Everyone, we are really doing a, like, you know, from the sublime to the ridiculous kind of thing. So something fits somehow, yeah. You know.
Yeah. It fits with with Matt's question, who's this for? This is a nothing for nobody kind of movie.
Perfect. I have the subtitle now for the episode title. That's great. Awesome. I don't have to think of one. Nothing for nobody. Great. For nobody. Okay. Writing it down. I can't spell. I wrote nothing for Moby.
Oh, what does that mean? There's nothing for Moby in this movie.
Nobody. Okay.
No, he was turned down for the soundtrack. Turned down, but considered.
Yeah, he was too busy doing the Bourne movies. Was that Moby?
It was, yeah.
Okay. All right, good. Okay, bye. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
I just woke up my cat by screaming bye.
Goodbye, everybody.
He's back to sleep.
Thanks, bye. Bill. Thanks, everybody. Bye.